This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello, and this is the first interview in our LOFAR segment. I'm joined by Dr. Neil Jackson. So, first up, LOFAR's quite an unusual telescope in the design and look of it. It doesn't really look like a normal telescope. Why is that?
Yes, it looks totally different. When you think of a telescope, you usually think of a large dish which rotates around the sky. The LOFAR array, or an individual station of the LOFAR array, basically consists of a series of sticks in the ground, so it's basically aerials which pick up radio waves, and another series of what's basically the aerials covered with sheeting. And it's a series of these aerials pick up these radio waves, and all of these signals that come into the individual aerials are combined by electronics and computing in order to form an image of the sky. So each aerial can see a very wide angle in the sky, but what you do is you use electronics and computing to adjust all the signals coming into these individual aerials in order to point at a particular area of sky that you want to. So it's virtually got no moving parts, unlike a conventional telescope. It's electronics and computing that actually selects where you want to look at and then forms your image of the sky.
So does that mean it's able to change its resolution on the fly? Can it observe large areas and then observe small areas and then go back and maybe even look at the same data?
Yes, it's very flexible in that way. You can look at various different parts of the sky at the same time. So you can put several beams on the sky where you look at a set of beams which are close together but not the same point. So you can look at several different things at once. And depending on the frequency, it has a very wide field of view. So at its lowest frequency, so it will go down to 30 megahertz or even below, at the lowest frequency, the field of view can be tens of degrees. It's a very wide field instrument. And that makes it ideal, among other things, for doing surveys of the sky. Even at the higher frequencies, if you go up to 200 megahertz, it has a field of view that's much wider than most conventional telescopes.
Most people would probably associate those sort of frequency levels with sort of commercial radio. How do you handle problems to do with picking up signals from commercial radio?
Well, a lot of commercial radio in the FM band, which is around 90-100 megahertz, there are two LOFAR bands. There's the low band, which runs from 10 megahertz to about 80-90 megahertz, and there is the high band, which goes from 120 megahertz up to 240. And there is, of course, a big gap in there, because in the middle of that is where you really don't want to be if you're doing radio astronomy. There is quite a lot of pickup of radio interference in the bands that LOFAR observes in, but there are fairly sophisticated algorithms and ways that you can identify and reject any channels of your data that are contaminated with interference. So you lose 10-20% of your data to interference, but that's okay. You can identify and throw the bad bits away, and you can live with that reasonably happily.
Does the size of the telescope and the fact that the stations are so spread out help you to get rid of noise? Because presumably the noise environment at each station is quite different.
Yes, it is. So having an interferometer means that you automatically reject noise that doesn't correlate between the two. But if the noise is so bad that it saturates your receiver, essentially, then you've got a problem. So even though it is an interferometer, you have to delete chunks of the data where there is interference. The other problem is the ionosphere above the Earth, because it's a bit like looking through moving water in a swimming pool. You have a point spread function which varies over your field, and that varies with time as well as the ionosphere that you're looking through changes. So again, there is a lot of algorithm development going into removing the ionosphere from maps, and it seems to work quite well. But again, it's another thing that you have to worry about when you're making images.
Okay. It could be interesting just to explain about the point spread function, because I always think that's interesting. You might kind of imagine that a telescope just looks at something, but basically the point spread function is telling you that no instrument is completely perfect at seeing.
Yes, that's right. So if you have a resolution of an arc second, say, then even an infinitely small blob will be smeared out into a disk of about an arc second. What the ionosphere does is it gives you a point spread function that is, in general, a funny shape, and also which varies with time. So it can make interpretation of images very difficult unless you get rid of it. And the ionosphere is getting particularly bad now because we're getting towards solar maximum, so that certainly doesn't help.
Also, I noticed that LOFAR is quite spread around the whole of Europe. It's got a site based in Britain, France, a few in Germany, and then big splodge right in the middle in the Netherlands. Is there a sort of a reason why you picked this configuration?
Yes, it was designed for a wide range of science. So the extended baselines, which is the connection of the telescopes in Holland with the telescopes in the rest of Europe, that gives you high resolution. So you can get sub-arcsecond resolution at the higher frequencies. You can see structures in the sky on scales of better than an arcsecond. The fact that you have a lot of telescopes in the core of LOFAR, which is located in the northeast of the Netherlands, that means that you can get very good sensitivity to very large-scale structures, and that's what's wanted for some scientific applications.
Moving on to the scientific applications, what will you be doing particularly with LOFAR? What's your interest?
Okay, and the project I'm involved in with a lot of others is a project to do surveys of large areas of the sky. Because LOFAR has a very wide field of view, it's ideal for doing large-scale sky surveys. And the idea is to do sky surveys of essentially the whole northern sky at various frequencies. And hopefully we should be able to do those sky surveys also at high resolution by using the international baselines. There are a fair number of technical problems with doing that, but we hope we can, over the next few years, try and overcome these and get the surveys going. My particular interest is looking for gravitational lens systems, which are systems where a background object is multiply imaged by foreground objects. And because LOFAR is doing such large-scale surveys, which will pick up such vast numbers of background sources, then the hope is that some fraction of them will have something close enough along the line of sight to form a gravitational lens system. And just because the numbers are so vast, then we hope to get a number of these systems.
What sort of things can you glean from measuring so many dozens, hundreds of gravitational lens events?
Well, the basic idea of gravitational lensing is that it gives you a handle on mass distributions independent of the light that is emitted. So if you study lens systems, then you can find out things about the mass distribution, including, of course, the dark matter in the thing that is responsible for doing the lensing. Studies of radio lensed systems, so studies of systems where the lensed object is a radio emitter, are currently stuck for lack of numbers, basically. The surveys of radio loud lens systems are not very complete. There's probably about 20 or 30 of them known. There are many more optical lens systems known, and there are reasons why we want to find radio loud gravitational lens systems.
And when you go to these lower frequencies, is that going to help you to pick up more lenses or to see lenses with a higher sensitivity?
We're mainly interested in the high frequencies because that's where you get the good resolution. So our interest really is to use it as a vast search engine for vast numbers of radio sources.
So it's not specifically that it's way down below the frequencies that other telescopes see at, but rather the speed of survey.
That's correct, yes. So quite a lot of the other projects within the surveys and also other projects such as the Epoch of Reionization project are specifically interested in the fact that it can observe at very low frequencies. Because for some classes of sources, such as relic radio sources, potentially high redshift sources, and also for studying the reionization signal of the universe, you want to be at low frequencies to do that.
And so you mentioned there the reionization signal. Could you explain what that is?
Okay, yes. One project that is using LOFAR is trying to detect the signal from the reionization of the universe. Now, what happened there was that after atoms formed, after the universe became cool enough for protons and electrons to combine together to form hydrogen atoms. After that, the universe went quiet and dark for quite a long time. And that was basically because stars had not yet formed and quasars had not yet formed. That situation persisted for quite a long time until what's known as the epoch of reionization, which basically means that stars formed, quasars formed, and photons began to be released from those events in large numbers, which then reionized parts of the universe, steadily increasing in volume. And we think that most of that happened at a redshift of somewhere around 10, although it went on for quite a while. And you can detect the signal from that, at least in principle, by observing at low far frequencies. It's actually a very difficult measurement. It's a very worthwhile measurement, but if it was easy, it would have been done already. It's a difficult measurement because, of course, there's lots of other foregrounds. So there's foregrounds not only in our own galaxy, but there's also foregrounds in the ionosphere above the Earth, which is not only a problem for the reionization experiment, it's a problem for everyone else who have to try and get rid of the ionosphere as well.
So when you're looking for that light at redshift 10, that's really, really old. It's something that comes from when the universe was quite young then.
Yes, and the people who do that, who are based in Groningen, are developing techniques to remove all the contamination, which is many, many times stronger than the signal that they're looking for.
Okay, well, what about the other key science projects that people want to do at LOFAR?
Okay, well, the main scientific applications, apart from large-scale surveys and all you can use them for, and apart from the epoch of reionization, there's also a program on pulsars and transient sources, and there is a program on cosmic magnetism, which is basically looking at magnetic fields in galaxies by looking at the polarization of the radio waves. There are also other programs as well on solar physics, because it's the sun is interesting at low frequencies, and there's a program which is looking at that.
I have one more question about surveys, actually. Is it practical to survey the entire sky at once and then keep all the data and then combine it in all the different ways to form the different beams on the different bits of the sky? Or is it just too much data to store an entire survey?
It's too much data. Unless you keep restricted amounts of the data, it's actually very difficult to keep all of the data. LOFAR is capable of producing many terabytes of data per day. There has been a petabyte of storage bought in one or two places, but even that assumes that you don't actually keep all of the raw data, because there is just so much of it. So what will probably happen with the surveys is that the data will be used to build up good maps and catalogues, and then, unfortunately, you can't keep all of the raw data. You can just keep probably restricted subsamples of it.
Okay, but you can always keep going back and resurveying, I suppose, if you need to.
Yes, and the idea is to have a sky model which starts off by including very bright sources in a very crude sort of way, and then gradually gets deeper and deeper and more detailed until you've included all of the millions of sources and you just keep updating that from the new data.
Does that require big optical fiber networks between all the different positions to be able to handle that much data?
Yes, there are 10 gigabit links going all around the network, and those lead back to a central correlation station in Groningen. So there is a supercomputer in Groningen which spends all its time churning through correlating signals from the different LOFAR telescopes in the various countries, and it outputs correlated signals that you can then process into a radio map. But even the amount of correlated data that the correlator in Groningen outputs is huge. So even once you've done that, you need a lot of offline computing to actually process that data after you've taken it.
So this is just the sort of telescope that couldn't have been created before there was this much computing power around then?
Yes, that's right. It's a case of buy computers as late as you can, because if they've got a factor of two more powerful, then that's really useful.
Okay, thank you very much, Neil Jackson.
Okay, thank you.